This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, it is Hall of Fame week in the basketball world, with the class of 2021 set to be enshrined in Springfield, Massachusetts, in the Basketball Hall of Fame. Among those being inducted is Paul Pierce, the 10-time All-Star who spent many, many years plying his craft just down the road in Boston. As part of our coverage, my profile of Paul Pierce is running on SI.com this week. I spoke to a lot of people for that profile, people that are part of Pierce's college years, like Roy Williams, former teammates like Antoine Walker, coaches and executives like Doc Rivers and Danny Ainge. So for this podcast, I took some of the longer portions of their interviews and excerpted them here to try to paint a picture of the career that Paul Pierce had, which can be divided into a series of moments. And I try to illuminate some of those moments on this podcast. So here it is, my look back on the career of Paul Pierce. Over a decorated 19-year NBA career, Paul Pierce made 10 All-Star teams, scored more than 26,000 points, and won one NBA championship. For those accomplishments, Pierce will be enshrined in the Basketball Hall of Fame this week. For Pierce, his career can be divided into a series of moments. The first, the 1998 NBA Draft. In 1997, Pierce considered leaving Kansas after his sophomore season. He chose to return, in part because he believed another strong season would push him into the top five of the draft. Yet on draft night, Pierce, from a seat in the green room, watched in horror as he tumbled down the draft board. Here's Kansas coach Roy Williams.
Even when he was in high school, I had a call from the people with the McDonald's All-American game, and I felt like that I had to promote him to make the McDonald's team, and I was really stunned. And again, I did try to promote him. He was selected and got in the game as a lead scorer in the game. I think tied the record for most points at that time in a McDonald's game. But I think people looked at Paul and wondered about his athleticism versus his somewhat, now please make sure you put this the right way, people looked at his athleticism or looked at him and said, well, he's old school, you know, he's a step in, fake up, get you to lean in and foul him. But he had both. It's just that's the way he played. But I think there was that question mark of would he be able to score in the NBA game like how easily he scored in college.
Pierce believed he had a good shot at landing in Vancouver, which owned the second overall pick. The Grizzlies, to Pierce's surprise, went with Arizona guard Mike Bibby. Here's former Grizzlies general manager Stu Jackson.
I don't recall all the negatives. We thought he had great size for position. You know, we liked the fact that offensively he was, you know, prolific, had a great first step. I mean, that's what really struck me in the workout, is the guy really could have exploded off the mark. Even though, if there was one small negative, no one thought he was a great athlete, you know? Neither was Mike Bibby, for that matter. But that was the only knock that we could have on him. And, you know, as I recall, his defensive, you know, what I'll call anthropometric sort of measurements weren't great, you know, slide, lateral slide, things like that, as quick as he was, you know, off the dribble and, you know, from a standstill on his first step, as I remember. So the defensive end sort of concerned us a little bit, but, you know, but other than that, there weren't very many negatives. I really liked him as a guy, as a person. He handled himself extremely well. You know, he was competitive. And all the things that, you know, a lot of people had good things to say about him.
Boston, with the 10th pick, never envisioned Pierce being available. For weeks, the Celtics had been locked in on Dirk Nowitzki, the German forward Rick Pitino, then the Celtics president, and Chris Wallace, the GM, pined for. But on draft night, Dallas swung a deal with Milwaukee to make Nowitzki a Maverick. That trade sent the Celtics scrambling. Here's Patino.
So we're scurrying. This is now number nine. We have 5 minutes and Pierce is not even on our radar. So we don't know why, because he was expected to go 2, 3, or 4. So now we're confused. There's got to be something wrong. You start thinking of everything, and I immediately got a hold of some Kansas people who I was friendly with, and they said, "Nah, great guy. You'll love coaching him. He's very easy to coach, the whole bit." And I said, "Holy shit." I had like 10, 15 minutes. I think the trade went down. I forgot exactly when it went down. But so we never even looked at Paul, never even thought about Paul. That was literally a last-second decision.
And here's Chris Wallace.
We're all in on Nowitzki, as in as you can get in, okay?
Right.
But I had bad feelings because of Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
Because Dallas is very international-oriented. You know, Donnie Nelson, that was at the sort of the beginning. You know, the international thing had been in a little while, but it hadn't really taken off yet.
Right.
But Donnie had more international experience than anybody in the league probably at the time. And then Rick got a little nervous, because he's like, what does everybody know that we don't know? What the hell's going on? You know, da 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 da. And I just said, well, if he's there, just don't worry about what we know. Don't know. Let's just take him.
We were pissed off at first. But then the next day when we started calling Roy Williams and started calling around to the Kansas staff, we knew that we got a steal with Paul Pierce, and that there was absolutely nothing wrong with him, that he just slipped, and there was no reason. Now, he may have had some mediocre workouts, I don't know, because I wasn't doing my homework on Paul at all.
Pierce was an instant success in Boston. Slipping in the draft pushed him to arrive in camp with a chip on his shoulder. Here's Celtics teammate Antoine Walker.
He came in with a killer mentality, very cocky, very confident. In his ability, and wanted to be good. I definitely wanted, he wanted to be really good. He wanted to be one of the elite. So I do remember the way he came in and wanted to make an impact right away.
Pierce averaged 16.5 points per game as a rookie. He finished third in voting for Rookie of the Year. Any concerns about Pierce's ability to score at the NBA level dissolved quickly. He averaged nearly 20 points during his second season. He was, by any estimation, on his way to becoming a star. Here's Williams.
I mean, when he goes to the Celtics, after 2 weeks of practice, I called him and said, Paul, do you feel like that you are prepared? Did we prepare you for what they've thrown at you the last 2 weeks? And he said, oh, coach, he said, this is unbelievable. He said, half these guys can't even run a play. He said, I think I'm way ahead of everybody. And I said, well, son, I always want to check, because I want to win as many games as we can, but I also want to get you prepared for the next level. He said, coach, this is great. I just want you to know I feel great about this. And then I told the Celtics, I said, hey, just understand, he's going to be in the NBA for 12 to 15 years. You've got a guy that's going to be with you forever, and he's going to be the face of the team.
And then it was nearly taken away. On September 25th, 2000, Paul Pierce arrived at the Buzz nightclub in Boston. He was accompanied by Tony Battee, a Celtics teammate, and Battee's brother, Derek. At the club, Pierce approached two women. While they spoke, a man approached and told Pierce one of the women was his sister. Pierce says he apologized. And that's one of the last things he remembers. A champagne bottle crashed on the side of his head. A group of men swarmed him and began stabbing Pierce across the back, chest, and stomach. One knife wound punctured his lung. Another slipped half an inch from his heart. The Battees eventually dragged Pierce away and rushed him to a nearby hospital. Still groggy, Pierce asked the doctors, am I going to live? Rick Pitino.
Well, I remember going to the hospital where his mom was and being told that if the blade was moved a centimeter, I forgot whether it was left to right, he wouldn't be alive. When I looked at him at the hospital that night, I truly was worried that his career was over, the way he looked. But the most amazing thing was the next day, how he looked from that night to the next day blew me away. Because when I visited him at the hospital, I said, at least his season's over. So he made a remarkable recovery, but he was also extremely fortunate and lucky.
Chris Wallace.
I get a call 4:30 in the morning because I didn't hear anything the night before. And I don't know if anybody got in contact with me. I get a call from Jeff Noyes, who's Rick's executive assistant, and saying Paul's been stabbed. You know, he's very serious, you know, condition, critical, that sort of thing. And I'm trying to think which hospital. He was at Tufts, I believe, in downtown Boston, which played an important role in his eventual recovery. And so I get up and get dressed and drive into traffic. You know, I mean, drive down there. There's no traffic at that time of morning. And the whole way, I'm just, my mind's racing, and there's no updates on the radio, or it's not today like social media and Twitter. I'm in the car by myself with no additional information other than what I heard initially. So I'm like, is he alive? I mean, what the hell? And so I get to the hospital. I go up on the ICU floor, and it's like out of a movie. He's behind glass, I mean, so they can see him in a bed. He's, you know, he's out. He's got tubes going everywhere. And I'm like, good God. I mean, is this guy going to make it? And so I didn't really get the information for a couple hours that he was definitely out of the woods as far as, you know, losing his life was concerned, which is obviously the big issue right then. So I mean, this was scary as hell.
Miraculously, Pierce not only recovered, but a month later, he was in the Celtics starting lineup on opening night. Pierce played all 82 games that season, averaging a career-best 25 points per game. He did it while wearing a vest underneath his jersey to protect his body from the physical trauma, while every day grappling with the mental trauma that came with nearly losing his life. Here's Patino.
Well, to tell you the truth, when I went to the hospital and saw him, I didn't think there's any way he's going to play.
Mm-hmm.
And then just 48 hours later, it was remarkable the recovery he made. Mm-hmm. And also to be tough enough to not only play, but play great after that incident. I mean, that's remarkable, you know, in the future, after getting stabbed, that, you know, down the road when he recovered, what it was like.
That was unbelievable. That's what I was talking about. You didn't know what to expect. Mm. He had to, you know, he could have easily laid down and, you know, obviously getting stabbed that many times, you know, I think, you know, it shows how much heart and competitiveness he had and how blessed he was to be able to come back and play. But kind of sums up what type of player that he was. That's how tough he was as a player. And I think that's what really people that started to make, especially in Boston, made people really become really fond of him and started to become a fan of him.
Over the next few years, Pierce blossomed into one of the NBA's top forwards. He was an all-star in 2002. He led the NBA in total points scored that same season. After Pierce scored 42 points against the Lakers in 2001, Shaquille O'Neal labeled Pierce the Truth, a nickname that stuck for the rest of his career. In 2002, the Celtics, led by Pierce and Antoine Walker, advanced to the Eastern Conference Finals. Pierce believed a championship was within reach. Danny Ainge, however, did not. In 2003, the Celtics hired Ainge, a member of the 1980s titles teams in Boston, to run basketball operations. One of Ainge's first moves was to trade Walker, ending what had been a successful Walker-Pierce partnership. Here's Walker.
I was disappointed. I mean, I was devastated, actually. More, I mean, would be the exact words. I was devastated. I thought we were finally building something where we had had a playoff run, even though we had got swept. We went against a team that went to the finals twice. We were right there with New Jersey. We played them over a two-year span, probably 20 times. I mean, we were really in heavy competition with them. And we knew we had to get a little better personnel-wise. We thought we was probably a point guard away from really making a real serious run. And then coming off that, me and Paul believed that we can get it done. We had such a level respect of the of us as a duo. We knew each other really, really well. We can get it. We can get on each other. We can push each other. It was nothing that we couldn't do to each other. We had that type of a special bond. So I was devastated. I couldn't believe that I had got traded.
Pierce wondered if he would be next, but Ainge didn't see it that way. He believed in Paul Pierce. He just didn't think Pierce had the right cast around him. Here's Ainge.
I loved Paul from an outsider looking in, like doing broadcasting, following the NBA and broadcasted, you know, many Celtics games. I was a big, big fan of Paul Pierce. Mm-hmm. And I thought he was a very special player. So when I had the opportunity to, when I took over the Celtics job, I mean, he was the only untouchable guy on that team. And I just felt like the team had done pretty well a couple of years prior, but that the team was not sufficient enough for Paul to have much success at that moment in time. It felt like we needed to make lots of changes. Even before I signed the contract and took the job, I had that opinion.
The next few years were among the darkest for Pierce as a professional. The Celtics won 36 games in 2003-2004, eliminated from the playoffs in the first round. Jim O'Brien, who had stabilized the team after Rick Pitino quit in 2001, resigned midway through the season. In 2004, Ainge hired Doc Rivers as head coach. Like Ainge, Rivers came into the situation a believer in Pierce. Here's Rivers.
Well, one game, coach of the Magic, and he was killing us. And at halftime, I'm like, how is a fat, unathletic guy killing us? And then I told him, when you get there, you realize, first of all, that wasn't fat at all. He was in great shape, but he was a super athlete. But he was so fundamentally sound that you often missed his athleticism, you know, and so we laugh about it a lot.
The Celtics, though, were rebuilding, and Rivers, while a fan of Pierce's talents, wanted him to continue to evolve as a player.
Because I came in, you know, with the mindset that I had to help Paul see that he had to play a different game to be great, you know, like, he didn't need me to. He was talented and skilled, and he didn't need me to change his game. He just, I thought where I was important for him is his shot selection and how he played. You know, lended for him to be, not efficient. And so early in it, if you remember that whole thing, it's been written about probably 100 times, but. You know, early in the year, I called a man and said, Paul, are you a great shooter? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, you're shooting like 40%. Mm. And I said, so either you're a great shooter and taking bad shots, or you're not a great shooter. And, you know, for him to hear that from, he was an all-star already. You know, so he was taken aback by that. And so I told him what I thought would make him a better player. Getting off the ball, getting back to the ball and moving and not being a stationary target and holding the ball and dancing, which made, I thought defensively, it easy to guard him, especially on a team that wasn't that great. I thought it really easier. And so I told him that I really believe that I'm not going to change. I'm going to push it on him. And, you know, at the end of the day, it'll be good for him. Mm-hmm. You know, and, one thing I learned, Chris, as a coach is, you know, especially with a guy like that, sometimes you got to make a decision. Do they want to change? Is it good for them? And then the last question is, are they just satisfied where they're at? And that's good. Or are they, the way I coach them is, I want to coach you to who you're going to be someday, not who you are today. Mm-hmm. But some guys don't want that, and you have to try to figure that out as a coach, whether they could be better or not. Some guys are happy, you know what I'm saying? And the reason I went that route with Paul, because he was in the gym every day. Mm-hmm. like working on his game every day. And so I'm thinking that this guy clearly wants to be better. It's not even close. Now it's my job to convince him there's a better way to become better. And if you remember the big game, I don't know what game it was, but down the stretch of a game, you know, he kept hoping for a 1-point game, but I took him out. With, you know, 5 minutes left in the game, didn't put him back in. We lost the game. And after the game, I walked in the locker room in front of the team. I said, hey, Paul, if you think I'm going to change, you're nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he had something to say. We went back and forth. I thought that went on for a couple of weeks. And then Paul, on his own, walks in my office and says, we're good. I got you. I'm open-minded. And I've never even looked. I can't even tell you, but I don't know what his percentage was in the first year that I got there before that year compared to the end of that year. But I guarantee you it was a big improvement.
Mm-hmm.
And once that happened, the trust was there.
Pierce's issues with Rivers were resolved, but his issues with the Celtics remained. In the prime of his career, Pierce wanted to play for a contender. By 2006... Boston looked far from it. The Celtics won 24 games during the 06-07 season. Over several meetings with Boston's front office, Pierce expressed his frustrations. Here's Ainge.
You know, the most difficult time was in the year that we were really struggling in 06-07 when Paul got hurt. You know, that was when we basically told Paul, you know, meeting with Paul, not just in one meeting that we had with Wick and Pags, but trying to keep Paul on board with the team while he was fighting an injury and trying to get him to see the hope and the potential, because we really felt like we were set up in a position to do something big in the summer, having no idea at that moment in time that we would get KG and Ray to play with him, but felt like there was an opportunity to be better, much better than we were, to be, you know, that lottery team. Well, and I just always respected Paul because he was good about it. He handled it and managed it well. At the same time, we were good to Paul in that if we can't do this, we will try to help you find a team that to your liking.
Mm.
If we can't do this. And so it was a good solution through a difficult time.
In the summer of 2007, everything changed. Ainge engineered the trades that brought Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen to Boston. Suddenly, the Celtics were a contender. Pierce was reinvigorated. He played 80 games that season. On a team with two other scorers, Pierce still averaged nearly 20 points. His biggest contribution, says Rivers, had nothing to do with the numbers.
Letting Kevin be the leader. And Paul was one of the leaders, Ray and all that, but Kevin was the leader of that team. And, like, I guess, I don't know how many times that's ever happened. You know, maybe Wade to LeBron, mm-hmm. you know. But it was immediate, and I don't think Paul gets enough credit for that.
Mm.
Because it was Paul's team. Like, he was there, and Kevin and Ray were coming in. For Paul to give up that much trust to someone else is not done very often. It also tells you how bad he wanted to win. Like, Paul was at that place, man, and where he wanted to win. Mm. And as Chuck Daly always says, sometimes, you know, you have to wait for players to really get to that point where they actually do want to win.
The Celtics won the championship in 2008. Injuries likely prevented Boston from winning another, but the Celtics were among the NBA's best teams until 2013. When Ainge broke up an aging roster, shipping Pierce and Garnett to Brooklyn. But it was in those years that Pierce solidified his credentials as a Hall of Fame player. Brian Scalabrine, a teammate of Pierce from 2005 to 2010, told me no player thrives in chaos better than Paul Pierce. Rivers and Ainge agree, while seeing other Hall of Fame attributes.
I would say what made him a Hall of Famer is his brain, his fundamental skills, and his tempo. He played, you know, I always, even today, I call it the Paul Pierce tempo. And you can see it when young guys have it. You know, I remember Damian Lillard, right when he came in, I said, fuck, he's got Paul's tempo already. You know, you're not going to rush him. He's going to do what he needs to do. I mean, Paul would tell you, you know, coach, he's the only player I would say, hey, where do you want to take the shot at? When I was drawing up an ATO, you know, other guys, I say, hey, I can get you the ball here. Where do you want the ball? Paul, it was where you want to take the shot, because you knew if you got him the ball in a spot, he can get to his spot. And he was just a remarkable scorer, very efficient, and he just had balls. He really did. He had big balls.
Well, I mean, other than the fact that he was just a great player, you know, one of my favorite characteristics of Paul was his love for basketball. And so when Paul would come out and, you know, he'd give it all, you know, he would really be into the game, and he wouldn't have success early on, I always felt like, you know, there's a really good chance he's going to have a really good second quarter. And if he didn't have a good second quarter, there's a really good chance he's going to have a good third quarter. You know, he would give it multiple efforts at stretches when things weren't going his way. You know, you could see his frustration. It wasn't like he hid it, but he had a love and passion for basketball. And it just always felt like he just wanted to play. He just loved playing. You know, Isaiah was a little bit like that too, but he just loved to play basketball. He practiced, he played, he didn't miss games, he didn't miss practices. I mean, you know, he did extra, played one-on-one. He didn't love drills, but he loved to, you know, play and talk and, you know, talk trash and have fun. And he just found, it just felt like he was a really happy person on the basketball court. And you know, that's what I appreciated about Paul as much as anything was, you know, just how much joy he found in playing.
For more on Paul Pierce and his journey into the Hall of Fame, head over to SI.com.